Between friends. I. Like a man who re-enters a closed and darkened house and lies down, lying there, remains conscious of sunlight outside, of bird calls, and the breeze in the trees, so Adrien entered into the obscurity of himself. Through the chambers of his brain, the twilight corridors where cringed his bruised and disfigured soul, there nothing stirring except the automatic pulses which never cease. Sometimes, when the sky itself crashes earthward and the world lies in ruins from horizon to horizon, life goes on. The things that men live through, and live. But no doubt death was too busy elsewhere to attend to Dream. He had become very lean by the time it was all over. Gray glinted on his temples, gray softened his sandy mustache, youth was finished as far as he was concerned. An odd idea persisted in his mind that it had been winter for many years. And the world thawed out very slowly for him. But broken trees leaf out, and huge roots sprout, and what he had so long mistaken for wintry ashes now gleamed warmly like the orange and gold of early autumn. After a while he began to go about more or less, little excursions from the dim privacy of mind and soul, and he found the sun not very gray, and a south wind blowing in the world once more. Quare and Gilder were in the studio that day on business. Dream continued to modify his composition in accordance with Gilder's suggestions. Quare, always curious concerning Dream, was becoming slyly impudent. And listen to me, Gilder. What the devil's a woman between friends? Argued Quare, with a malicious side glance at Dream. You take my best girl away from me. But I don't, remarked his partner dryly. For the sake of argument, you do. What happens? Do I raise hell? No. I merely thank you. Why? Because I don't want her if you can get her away. That, he added, with satisfaction, is philosophy. Isn't it, Dream? Gilder intervened pleasantly. I don't think Dream is particularly interested in philosophy. I'm sure I'm not. Shut up, please. Dream, gravely annoyed, continued to pinch bits of modeling wax out of a round tin box, and to stick them all over the sketch he was modifying. Now and then he gave a twirl to the top of his working table, which revolved with a rusty squeak. If you two unusually intelligent gentlemen ask me what good a woman the world, began Quare. But we don't, interrupted Gilder, in the temperate voice peculiar to his negative character. Anyway, insisted Quare, here's what I think of 'em. My model, yonder, said Dreen, a slight shrug of contempt, happens to be feminine, and may also be human. Be decent enough to defer the development of your rather tiresome theory. The girl on the model stand laughed outright at the rebuke, stretched her limbs and body, and relaxed, launching a questioning glance at Dream. All right, rest a bit, said the sculptor, smearing the bit of wax he was pinching over the sketch before him. He gave another twirl or two to the table, wiped his bony fingers on a handful of cotton waste, picked up his empty pipe, and blew into the stem, reflectively. Quare, one of the associated architects of the new opera, who had been born a gentleman and looked the perfect bounder, sauntered over to examine the sketch. He was still red from the rebuke he had invited. Gilder, his senior colleague, got up from the lounge and walked over also. Dream fitted the sketch into the roughly designed group, where it belonged, and stood aside, sucking meditatively on his empty pipe. After a silence. It's all right, said Gilder. Quare remarked that the group seemed to lack flamboyancy. It is true, however, that, except for Gilder's habitual restraint, the celebrated firm of architects was inclined to express themselves flamboyantly, and to interpret Renaissance in terms of Baroque. She's some girl, added Quare, looking at the lithe, modeled figure, and then half turning to include the model, who had seated herself on the lounge, and was now gazing with interest at the composition sketched in by Dream for the facade of the new opera. Carpo and his eternal group. It's the murderous but inevitable standard of comparison, mused Dreen, with a whimsical glance at the photograph on the wall. Carpo has nothing on this young lady, insisted Quare flippantly, and he pivoted on his heel and sat down beside the model. Once or twice the two others, consulting before the wax group, heard the girl's light, untroubled laughter behind their back scaly responsive to Quare's wit. Perhaps Quare's inheritance had been humor, but to some it seemed perilously akin to mother wit. The pockets of Gilder's loose, ill-fitting clothes bulged with linen tracings and rolls of blueprints. He and Dream consulted over these for a while, semi-conscious of Quare's bannering voice and the girl's easily provoked laughter behind them. And, finally. All right, Gilder, said Dream briefly. And the firm of celebrated architects prepared to evacuate the studio, Quare exhibiting symptoms of incipient skylarking, in which he was said to be at his best. Drop in on me at the office sometime, He suggested to the youthful model, in a gracious tone born of absolute self-satisfaction. "For luncheon or dinner?" retorted the girl, with smiling audacity. "You may stay to breakfast also."
"Oh, come on," drawled Gilder, taking his colleague's elbow.
The sculptor yawned as Square went out, then he closed the door, then celebrated firm of architects, and wandered back rather aimlessly. For a while he stood by the great window, watching the pigeons on neighboring roof. Presently he returned to his table, withdrew the dancing figure with its graceful, wide-flung arms, set it upon the squeaky revolving table once more, and studied it, yawning at intervals. The girl got up from the sofa behind him, went to the model stand, and mounted it. For a few moments she was busy adjusting her feet to the chalk marks and blocks. Finally she took the pose. She always seemed inclined to be more or less vocal while Dreen worked. Her voice, if untrained, was untroubled. Her singing had never bothered Dreen, nor, until the last few days, had he even particularly noticed her blood thrilling, as a man afield, preoccupied, is scarcely aware of the wild bird's gay irrelevancy along the way. He happened to notice it now, and a thought passed through his mind that the country must be very lovely in the mild spring sunshine. As he worked, the brief visualization of young grass and the faint blue of skies, evoked, perhaps, by the girl's careless singing, made for his dull concentration subtly pleasant environment. "May I rest?" she asked at length.
"Certainly, if it's necessary. I've brought my lunch. It's 12, she explained.
He glanced at her absently, rolling a morsel of wax, then, with slight irritation which ended in a shrug, he motioned her to descend. After all, girls, like birds, were eternally eating. Except for that, and incessant preening, existence meant nothing more important to either species. He had been busy for a few moments with the group when she said something to him, and he looked around from his abstraction. She was holding out toward him a chicken sandwich. When his mind came back from wool gathering, he curtly declined the offer, and, as an afterthought, bestowed upon her a wholly mechanical smile, in recognition of a generosity not welcome.
"Why don't you ever eat luncheon?" she asked.
"Why should I?" he replied, preoccupied. "It's bad for you not to. Besides, you are growing thin."
"Is that your final conclusion concerning me, Cecile?" he asked, absently.
"Won't you please take this sandwich?" Her outstretched arm, more than what she said, arrested his drifting attention again.
"Why the devil do you want me to eat?" he inquired, fishing out his empty pipe and filling it.
"You smoke too much. It's bad for you. It will do very queer things to the lining of your stomach if you smoke your luncheon instead of eating it." He yawned.
"Is that so?" he said.
"Certainly it's so. Please take this sandwich." He stood looking at the outstretched arm, thinking of other things, and the girl sprang to her feet, caught his hand, opened the fingers, placed the sandwich on the palm, then, with a short laugh as though slightly disconcerted by her own audacity, she snatched the pipe from his left hand and tossed it upon the table. When she had reseated herself on the lounge beside her pasteboard box of luncheon, she became even more uncertain concerning the result of what she had done, and began to view with rising alarm the steady gray eyes that were so silently inspecting her. But after a moment Dreen walked over to the sofa, seated himself, curiously scrutinized the sandwich which lay across the palm of his hand, then gravely tasted it.
"This will doubtless give me indigestion," he remarked.
"Why, Cecile, do you squander your wages on nourishment for me? It cost only 5 cents.
"But why present 5 cents to me? I gave 10 to a beggar this morning."
"Why?"
"I don't know."
"Was he grateful?"
"He seemed to be."
"This sandwich is excellent, but if I feel the worse for it, I'll not be very grateful to you." But he continued eating.
"The woman tempted me," she quoted, glancing at him sideways. After a moment's survey of her.
"You're one of those bright, saucy, pretty, inexplicable things that throng this town and occasionally flit through this profession, aren't you?"
"Am I?"
"Yes. Nobody looks for anything except mediocrity, you're one of the surprises. Nobody expects you, nobody can account for you, but you appear now and then, here and there, anywhere, even everywhere, a pretty sparkle against the gray monotony of life, a momentary flash like a golden mote afloat in sunshine, and what then?" She laughed.
"What then?
What becomes of you? Where do you go? What do you turn into?"
"I don't know."
"You go somewhere, don't you? You change into something, don't you? What happens to you, petite Seagal?"
"When?"
"When the sunshine is turned off and the snow comes."
"I don't know, Mr. Green. She broke her chocolate cake into halves and laid one on his knee. Thanks for further temptation, he said grimly. You are welcome. It's good, isn't it? Excellent. Adam liked the apple, too. But it raised hell with him. She laughed, shot a direct glance at him, and began to nibble her cake, with her eyes still fixed on him. Once or twice he encountered her gaze, but his own always wandered absently elsewhere. You think a great deal, don't you? She remarked. Don't you? I try not to, too much. What? He asked, swallowing the last morsel of cake. She shrugged her shoulders. What's the advantage of thinking? He considered her reply for a moment, her blue and rather childish eyes, and the very pure oval of her face. Then his attention flagged as usual, was wandering, when she sighed, very lightly, so that he scarcely heard it, merely noticed it sufficiently to conclude that, as usual, there was the inevitable hard luck story afloat in her vicinity, and that he lacked the interest to listen to it. Thinking, she said, is a luxury to a tranquil mind and a punishment to a troubled one. So I try not to. It was a moment or two before it occurred to him that the girl had uttered an unconscious epigram. It sounded like somebody, probably Montaigne. Was it? He inquired. I don't know what you mean. Oh. Then it wasn't. You're a funny little girl, aren't you? Yes, rather. On purpose? Yes, sometimes. He looked into her very clear eyes, now brightly blue with intelligent perception of his not-too-civil badinage. And sometimes, he went on, you're funny when you don't intend to be. You are, too, Mr. Green. What? Didn't you know it? A dull color tinted his cheekbones. No, he said, I didn't know it. But you are. For instance, you don't walk, you stalk. You do what novelists make their gloomy heroes do, you stride. It's rather funny. Really? And do you find my movements comic? She was a trifle scared, now, but she laughed her breathless, youthful laugh. You are really very dramatic, a perfect story.